Good morning. You're listening to the Mighty 690 KGGF. I am Matt Jordan here on this Tuesday morning. And on this second Tuesday, just like every month, we are joined by the Attorney General, Derek Schmidt. Good morning, Attorney General. How are you?
I'm well, Matt. Thanks. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great as well. We got a lot of stuff to talk about, but let's start first here with the redistricting. It's been a process, as you know. It was approved, veto overridden, and now there's been some lawsuits. So it's kind of, you know, gone through the gauntlet here.
Yes, that's true. I mean, you'll remember the big picture here, that this is something that has to be done every 10 years. And my view, at least, because it's only every 10 years, memories tend to fade. So this is the third round of redistricting I've lived through in some form as a public office holder. And every one of them has the same sort of wailing and gnashing of teeth and all sorts of high stress conflict. This one's no different. So in this case, the legislature approved new congressional district maps for Kansas. They haven't gotten to the state legislative maps yet. Kansas has four. We continue to have four, but populations moved around in the state, so boundaries have to be redrawn so that we get one person, one vote, equal population. The legislature did that. The governor vetoed it. The legislature overrode the governor's veto, and then folks who don't like the map marched into court and sued. All of that, in some form or another, tends to happen every time, except sometimes you don't get the veto, depending on how the legislature and the governor get along. We're at the lawsuit stage now, and so now we're involved because we're the state's attorneys, so we are defending the law as it was enacted. The one thing that's different this time is that the plaintiffs in these lawsuits, there have been two lawsuits filed so far. One is filed by National Democrat Organizations led by Eric Holder, the former Obama-era U.S. Attorney General, Mark Elias. He used to be Hillary Clinton's campaign attorney. And the other is led by the American Civil Liberties Union. They're both filed in state court, and that's what's new. Normally, when you're talking about lawsuits challenging a congressional redistricting, because, of course, those are federal seats in the U.S. Congress, normally those lawsuits get filed in federal court. Under federal law. But this time, the plaintiffs have decided to challenge them in state court, predominantly under state law. And you know, I think the reason is pretty obvious. For all the, again, wailing and gnashing of teeth, as I say, these particular maps they don't present any obvious legal defects. And so, under federal law. And so it looks like the plaintiffs are going to state court to try to persuade state courts to carve out some new rules, change the rules after the fact. And obviously we're going to defend against that, and we'll see where it all goes. So nothing really new under the sun. Like I say, this happens every 10 years with similar emotions, but we're just doing our job and defending the law the way it was written.
So what's the process kind of look like and the timetable, I guess, for the defending of this new law?
Well, one of the good things this cycle is the legislature passed this new congressional boundary map early in the session. Last time, 10 years ago, they actually never passed new maps. They deadlocked, couldn't agree on anything. And so the decisions wound up getting made very late. The districts were actually drawn by federal judges, not by legislators. And they were so late that the election timetable was fouled up 10 years ago. They actually had to push back the filing deadline and all kinds of stuff. This year, I think everybody involved agrees that because there was an early start, we don't want to lose that advantage. So everybody's trying to move these lawsuits as quickly as possible. We are, the plaintiffs are, and you know, it all just depends on how quickly the state courts decide to move on this. But I'm really hopeful we can get this thing resolved in court one way or the other, you know, in the fairly short horizon, within measured in weeks, not months. We'll see if that's in fact possible, but I'm hopeful. The filing deadline for candidates this time is noon on June 1st. And so, you know, all of these parts have to fit together so that that deadline and then others that are triggered along the way before the primary election in August, you know, can happen. So you got to have a certain number of days to print ballots. You got to know who the candidates are before you can print ballots. You got to know what the districts are before you know who the candidates are. So there's just a whole bunch of dominoes that have to fall in order here. And We're going to try to get our part done as quickly as the courts will allow.
Yeah, can't run for a certain district seat and then that end up not being your district. So you definitely got to figure it out before then. So, all right, moving on, let's talk a little bit about Kansas City, Kansas, with this adoption of a sanctuary city ordinance.
Yeah, so this is a national debate that was really noisy a few years back. It's still ongoing, but it's a bit quieter, at least not in the news as much. And Kansas, for the most part, had managed to avoid it until recently. But the issue here is that there are some communities, some cities or counties, where because of their local preferences or local politics, if you will, they don't want to cooperate with the enforcement of federal immigration law in one manner or another. Some are all in and just, you know, kind of stiff-arm the feds on immigration enforcement entirely. Others are just sort of nibbling around the edges and say, well, you know, we're not going to cooperate with this or cooperate with that, but the feds can do what the feds will do. So there's all different flavors of this, if you will, of this type of local sanctuary ordinance. In Kansas, there have been very few of these. There's a lot of talk, but at the end of the day, I believe the city of Lawrence is the only one that actually formally had adopted one up until this point. But now Kansas City, Kansas, Wyandotte County, after a years-long debate, has adopted one. And theirs is more aggressive. It tries to prevent their police department from assisting or cooperating with federal immigration authorities on immigration enforcement, sharing information, that sort of thing. And it also creates these local government identification cards, which can be obtained by anybody, regardless of whether they're in the country legally or not, and is, in my view at least, not entirely well-defined on what those government-issued ID cards can then be used for, which is the problem from a state standpoint. So, you know, we weren't consulted in all of this. If we had been, we would have advised there are some legal and practical limitations on trying to have local governments opt out of federal immigration enforcement. We are all in the same country, subject to the same federal law and the same immigration law. You know, I think it's unfortunate that Kansas City's chosen to go this route. I think it's going to really stir up a lot of dust. And I've suggested that the best path forward is for the legislature now to step in and enact state law that limits or eliminates the ability of local governments to do this. Because now that we have at least two of these jurisdictions in Kansas, there's a real risk of a patchwork developing where enforcement of federal law looks different in one town than it does in another, and that's not how federal law is supposed to work. So we're watching it closely. We'll have some recommendations for the legislature to put an end to this, and we'll see where it all goes. At the end of the day, everybody's trying to, you know, be good-hearted and welcoming to individual families and persons based on their circumstance, but the bottom line is the law, and there's a right way and a wrong way to come to this country. And we welcome those who come in the right way, and we shouldn't go out of our way to provide a particular special accommodation or benefits to those who come the wrong way.
Yeah, I definitely agree. You don't want to, you know, you can't make certain exceptions on certain things. It kind of opens up a can of worms that could have a real bad domino effect.
And it's very unfair to those who follow the rules. You know, in my experience, and the polling data bears this out as well, some of the strongest supporters of enforcing federal immigration law fairly uniformly and strongly around the country are first-generation immigrants who have come here the right way. They followed the rules. They stood in line, literally or metaphorically. And it can be very frustrating to some of those families then when others just sort of jump the queue and try to take shortcuts. So there's a reason the law exists and it ought to be enforced.
All right. Another thing we'll talk about here is the imprisonment of repeat felons who commit new violent crimes with firearms, as opposed to getting just probation. You know, because you know the law is you're not supposed to have a firearm if you're a felon, but it often leads just to probation instead of being put back into prison.
That's exactly right. You know, the expression is that if you want to stop gun crime, you ought to focus on the criminals who are misusing firearms instead of getting distracted in a debate about firearms themselves. And I think that I believe in that philosophy, and I think we need to be much stronger in terms of dealing with people who repeatedly, and that's a key word here, repeatedly use firearms to hurt other people in violation of the law. So our suggestion here is this. We actually have a hearing on this afternoon in the legislature. We'll see how it goes. Looks like the support's pretty strong. Our suggestion is this. It's already a crime in Kansas. If you're a convicted felon and you're, as a result of that, you're prohibited from possessing a firearm, it's already a crime if you nonetheless go out and possess a firearm. But that's a low-level felony, almost always results in probation. Our suggestion is that if you're a convicted felon and you illegally possess a firearm that you're not supposed to have because of your felony conviction, and then you go out and commit a new violent felony while you're carrying that firearm, you ought to do prison time, actual prison time, for the weapons charge. And we think that would have the tendency to be a real deterrent to some of those group of folks. Some you can't deter, but some of that group of folks who repeatedly use firearms to go out and hurt other people. It's gotten strong support from gun rights organizations, from law enforcement organizations. We think that as a practical matter, if we get this done, the reality is in many communities, maybe even most, but many communities, it's sort of the same group of people who keep committing crimes and hurting other people. They sort of cycle through the system. And if we could really target those folks that are violent, hurting others, using firearms as a weapon to do that, get them off the streets for a longer period of time, we think that could have a real positive benefit on public safety in our communities. So that's the proposal.
Yeah, I think, you know, I'm not surprised that it's got the support that it has from the groups it has, because, you know, when you talk about, it's a big topic, gun violence, but a lot of the times it is criminals, you know, with the amount of, you know, the job that I do, the amount of press releases I get where you just see that it's always, you know, mentioned. There's always, it seems like anytime a crime is committed, there's always a felon possessing a firearm is just another one of the things that's mentioned in there.
And the problem right now is that, you know, for some of these folks who run afoul of the criminal justice system, they know the law better than, you know, most citizens in a coffee shop do, because they interact with it, because they've been caught and prosecuted. And they know that as a practical matter, there actually is no consequence for carrying a gun to your next felony, because they know that it's almost certainly going to result in probation on the weapons charge. And that's almost certainly going to run concurrently with whatever the prison term is for the underlying felony you've just committed. So, you know, if there's no consequence, there's no deterrent. So we want to make sure that there is a consequence for making the decision. If you're a felon who's already had a chance and you're on your second chance and you blow that, if you're carrying a gun to that next crime, that's an additional problem for you when you get caught and prosecuted.
Absolutely. All right, well, we got a couple more minutes left here. Is there anything else you want to throw in before we wrap up this month's chat?
No, I appreciate the opportunity to visit with everybody and wish everybody well as you can kind of see spring on the horizon.
Yeah, warmer temperatures for the start of the week, and then it's going to cool back down in the middle and then warm back up. It's kind of a crazy time right now here in the middle of February.
Must be Kansas in the winter.
Absolutely. All right, well, Attorney General, thanks for coming on again this month. We'll look forward to talking to you next month, and hopefully we'll have an update on the redistricting by then, and that we've figured all that out.
Sounds great. Thank you.
All right. You're listening to the Mighty 690 KGGF. We'll take another break here, and then we'll come back with some Fox News. We got some weather coming up as well, and then local news by myself here on KGGF.